This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Just 20 years ago, the British scientist Alec Jeffries discovered that each person's genetic material, or DNA, has a unique pattern, a pattern that, much like a fingerprint, could be used to trace a sample of DNA back to a single person. That discovery revolutionized crime fighting. DNA samples are now routinely collected in all 50 states. They've been used to convict rapists and murderers, and in more than 150 cases, to free those who were wrongly accused of a crime in which the real culprit left a DNA sample behind. But there have been problems. In some cases, DNA collections have overwhelmed the ability of many police departments to actually analyze and catalog the samples. Charges of scientific incompetence or outright deception have been made against labs in at least 17 states, according to a report in this week's Chicago Tribune. Huge backlogs of samples, including rape kits that haven't been processed, sit on shelves. The National Institute of Justice, an office of the Justice Department, estimates that nationwide there are more than 500,000 unsolved cases with DNA evidence that has not yet been tested. To reduce some of that backlog and beef up scientific training at labs, President Bush recently signed into law the Justice for All Act of 2004. Well, will that be enough? Because even as thousands of samples sit unanalyzed on shelves, police and other law enforcement officials have lobbied to expand DNA databases to make a sort of library of individual DNA samples. So when a crime is committed and the DNA is left behind, police could then compare that sample to the database and see if there's a match. That lobbying has paid off, as in California, where the public voted to enlarge the DNA database in that state to include not only convicted felons, but everyone else arrested on suspicion of rape or murder. It's a controversial issue, as you might well imagine. We'll talk about that later in the program. If you'd like to join our conversation on DNA and crime fighting, give us a call on number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my first guest. Peter Newfield is a co-director of the with Barry Scheck of the Innocence Project. He joins us in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Where is the Innocence Project stand right now? Give us an idea of its scope. What you're working on?
Well, we're working currently on probably several hundred cases spread out across the country of people who claim to be innocent and hope that DNA testing can prove their actual innocence. These are all people who are already convicted, who had already exhausted their appeals. That's a large part of our work. Mm-hmm. The other thing we're doing is actually getting involved in all the issues that you told your listeners about at the beginning of the show, all the policy considerations, other applications of DNA. What do DNA exonerations tell us about other forensic sciences? Are they good? Are they bad? Crime labs, do they have enough quality assurance? Are they good? Are they bad? So we're involved in all the other aspects of criminal justice that we've learned about through this light being shined on it by DNA. Mm-hmm.
I briefly mentioned this past Saturday that the president signed the Justice for All Act of 2004. Tell us what's in that and why he signed that.
Well, the Justice for All Act is actually a good name for it because it has a little something for everybody. crime victims wanted certain things. People who represent folks on death row got something out of the bill. But the main thing in the bill obviously deals with DNA and forensic science. And first of all, it's going to provide about $1 billion over the next 5 years to state and local crime laboratories across America to enable them to deal with DNA backlogs and stay current with new crimes being solved. One misunderstanding that the public has is they think that you can solve every crime with DNA. You can't. In fact, according to most crime lab directors, only about 10 to 15% of the crimes lend themselves to having biological evidence, DNA examined. But in those cases, that's still a lot of crime, and it's very, very effective, and the labs were way backed up, sometimes a year and 2 years, and this money is absolutely necessary to allow them to try and get current in solving those crimes where DNA can make the difference.
And if the lab gets backed up, it opens itself up to shoddy charges of shoddy workmanship, wouldn't it?
Well, not so much shoddy workmanship if they get backed up. What a lot of the labs were doing, or the states were doing, is they would then have to send the items out to private laboratories to be tested. But what was happening is that, number one, crimes weren't being solved. Number two, very often an innocent person was arrested.
Right.
And if they could only do the DNA testing, they'd be able to clear that person and release him from jail. So it was a lose-lose unless you had prompt DNA testing. So this will really, you know, be a major breakthrough in that regard.
Do you ever get a case where somebody says, I'm in jail, I'm innocent, and you do a DNA test and it turns out he was guilty?
Oh, sure, that happens. I mean, you know, we look at our Innocence Project now. We've had 152 people exonerated through post-conviction DNA testing, but certainly in some instances when we take the case to the lab, the DNA testing proves guilt. But even if we have a 50 or 60% exoneration rate, that's extraordinary. That gives you some idea of how many tens of thousands of factually innocent people may be currently languishing in prison or, God forbid, on death row.
Is there any way to know how many people there might be? Tens of thousands, that's a good estimate?
Well, actually, our numbers come from a good source, come from the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI's had their DNA laboratory open since 1988, and they were keeping track of those cases where state and local governments sent them biological evidence for DNA testing where a suspect had already been arrested and charged with the crime. In sexual assault cases, they've been excluding the primary suspect about 25% of the time. So we're talking about tens of thousands of people being excluded now through pretrial testing. That gives you some indication about the number of people who were tried and convicted who were actually innocent before the advent of DNA testing.
Mm-hmm. There is a story in this week's Chicago Tribune that details problems in the forensic labs all over the country. And and a few years back, there was Joyce Gilchrist, a lab worker in Oklahoma, who worked on some 3,000 cases, some of them resulting in the death penalty. And the governor of Oklahoma called for a review of every case she worked on because of her incompetence. Is this atypical?
Oh, it's not atypical, unfortunately. You know, people would be surprised that we have more regulation and controls for a test to determine whether your kid has strep throat than we do for a test that will eventually send somebody to the electric chair or a lethal injection. Crime laboratories, by and large, have absolutely no government regulation in this country. New York State is one of the few states that has a regulatory scheme. Otherwise, there are professional associations that take care of themselves, and it's just not adequate. As a result of that, you have these crime lab scandals occurring all over the country, in the South, in the North, in the East, and the West, involving, a dozen different forensic disciplines, ballistics. The FBI was involved in a scandal because they used to suggest that they could identify that a particular bullet used in a shooting came from a box of cartridges recovered from a defendant's home. The National Academy of Science did an investigation and found out that's just silly. You can't do that. You can't give statistics on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've had scandals in Montana, Indiana, California, Florida. Texas is, of course, one of the biggest scandals at the Houston Crime Laboratory, where thousands and thousands of old serology cases now have to be reexamined. Ballistics cases will have to be reexamined. And, of course, we know that not only does Texas execute more people than any other state in the country, but in the Houston Crime Laboratory, where this scandal broke out, Harris County, where Houston sits, executed more people than any other state in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so what happens? Let's walk through a little bit. What happens when someone is arrested for a crime and DNA evidence is collected? Who does the DNA analysis? Is it the police department or is it independent lab? What happens to it?
In most jurisdictions now, because of the additional funding, states have set up their own state crime laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
And one component of the state crime laboratory will do DNA testing. In other jurisdictions, they have medical examiner's offices, and they will do the DNA testing for the police departments.
Mm.
In some very small jurisdictions where they don't have a good-sized laboratory, they would pay to have it sent out to a private laboratory. Those are the three different types of laboratories that do the bulk of the criminal investigation work for police departments.
And if I'm arrested and my DNA sample is taken, do I have a right to see the results or to observe the test?
Well, not to observe the test, but frankly, the procedures and protocols that are utilized in crime laboratories today are pretty standardized, mm-hmm. are pretty good. You'll get the results, and certainly your lawyer, if you're charged with the crime then, will have an opportunity to review the underlying lab notes as well as the final report. That's something that most folks don't realize, is that there's always a danger that a final report issued by a crime laboratory will not adequately reflect the underlying data.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a medical problem and somebody says that when they did a biopsy on a piece of tissue and it turned out to be malignant, your doctor could look at the underlying notes of that test to see whether or not they got the right result. And generally, that hasn't been the case in criminal justice, but that has to rapidly change.
Let's get a call in. Let's go to Joe in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hi, go ahead.
Quickly, I hear a lot of objections to people talk about invasion of privacy when we collect DNA samples from everybody that's arrested. I'm just curious how that's different from collecting fingerprints from everybody.
Well, Joe, one of the problems you had, for instance, in Louisiana recently, since you're from Baton Rouge, is there was a serial murderer who you may be aware of, and to try and locate that person, because he left a DNA deposit on most of his victims, they went around rounding up people and demanding that they give DNA samples. The problem is that when all those people were excluded and they eventually caught the real perpetrator, the state of Louisiana decided to keep all those samples on file. And people weren't pleased with that. People weren't pleased with that because fingerprints don't reveal very specific personal information about your predispositions for certain diseases, maybe predispositions for certain mental illness. And a lot of folks don't want the state to have that kind of information. I think it would be one thing if we agreed as a nation to have a universal database. But until such time that there's a consensus for that, I think it's wrong to simply single out people who haven't even been charged with a crime and demand that they give DNA samples and then the state retains them.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. What about the people who don't trust the police? I mean, they don't. We've seen that over and over again. And should the DNA lab work? And we talked about how shoddy some of the lab work is done. Why not have an independent body that will do all the DNA lab work for everybody and keep track and make sure and ensure that it's kept in a safe and reputable place?
Well, there's no question that in the whole area of forensic science, including DNA, we would be much better off if forensic science was primarily a science as opposed to something that's run by police departments. In all other scientific disciplines, it's considered crucial that the person who's doing the scientific test does the test blindly. In other words, he doesn't know how the result is supposed to turn out. Unfortunately, in most forensic science disciplines, the examiner, for instance, who's doing the DNA test knows that, well, this guy, we think he committed two other rapes, but we couldn't nail him on that. Or this guy, we got him with the murder weapon, so it's just a question of you confirming it with your test. Science, if it's to be pristine, if it's supposed to have integrity, should not work that way. Mm-hmm. Scientists should do the test clean of all that extraneous information and render a decision. If we had independent laboratories, we'd go a great distance toward achieving that.
Is that too expensive to do?
Oh, it's not more expensive. In fact, it can be done for less money than it currently is done because you have these large bureaucracies in the police departments. It's not about money. It's frankly a question of, I would almost call it folklore. It's the way it's always been done. Police departments have traditionally controlled these crime laboratories, so there's no need to change.
Police departments, just to raise another issue, have always used fingerprinting evidence, but I've heard it said by other scientists, if you would try to bring fingerprinting evidence into forensic science today, you couldn't. There are no studies that actually back it up.
Well, that's one of the other issues, is that, you know, real science, whether it's DNA or a test for cancer or heart disease, those tests and studies go through validation studies. The National Institutes of Health fund those studies.
Right.
The FDA approves procedures before they're put on the market.
You get published in papers. People read
you
about them.
You get peer-reviewed papers, people get to challenge the results. None of those safety mechanisms exist for forensic science. There is no NIH. There is no FDA. Peer review isn't required. If somebody in the local police department has a new widget for investigating forensic science, they're free to implement that without the appropriate checks and balances.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Peter Neufeld. We're also going to bring in Barry Steinhardt and talk about other forensic issues. So stay with us. We'll take a short break, come back, and take more of your calls. We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about DNA evidence this hour, and I've been talking with Peter Neufeld, co-director with Barry Shuck of the Innocence Project. Also, we're going to be talking now with Barry Steinhardt, who's director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Tell us what happened in California with this Proposition 69. All 50 states have DNA databases. What makes California's different?
Well, California's taken it the next step. What they've said is that people who are merely arrested for a crime will also be required to involuntarily give up a DNA sample. That really does take it to a whole new level. That's happened episodically across the country, but here you have the largest state in the nation that intends to make it their state policy.
So you don't have to be convicted of anything?
You don't have to be convicted of anything. If you are subsequently acquitted, there's a rather long, drawn-out, probably in most cases going to be unworkable process that would allow you to potentially get the information expunged, destroyed. But the truth is that the average person who's arrested for a crime for which he's not convicted is going to find that process very difficult to go through.
And tell us why this is not a good thing.
Well, you know, it's a question of what sort of society we want to live in. Do we want to be taking a DNA sample from people who are merely arrested, who've never been convicted of anything? You're going to have a lot of pretextual arrests that are made for the purpose of collecting those DNA samples. But, you know, ultimately we have to decide, do we want to live in a society where our DNA is on file with our state or federal government at every step of the way.
All right, Byron, are we heading in the direction, healthcare-wise, that sooner or later, right from birth, we're going to have our DNA profile made? Won't that be available anyhow?
Well, we put some protections into our medical privacy laws. The HIPAA law, for example, which is the federal law that governs medical records, offers some protection against the misuse of medical information for an unrelated third purpose. The problem with these DNA laws, DNA collection by criminal justice agencies and states, as Peter was just saying a moment ago, is, first of all, they're largely unregulated. There are very few restrictions on what can be done with that information. And secondly, the temptation here is to continue to expand the number of people who are swept up in this web, so that they increasingly are developing larger and larger databases of DNA information. DNA information which can be used for all sorts of purposes. It's not simply for identification purposes. That's the difference between DNA and a fingerprint. Fingerprint, to the extent to which that's a valid way of establishing identity, only does that. It only allows the police to establish your identity. Mm-hmm. It's not going to tell you something about that person's parentage. It won't tell you about their family members, as DNA will. It's certainly not going to tell you about diseases they may have proclivity for or even behavior they may have proclivity for.
Barry Neufeld?
No, Peter Neufeld.
I'm sorry.
Barry's my partner. And Barry's on the phone, but not me.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. You know, look, there's no question that the larger your database of DNA profiles, the more crimes you'll solve. It's very simple. I mean, right now, for instance, through the National Database System, they've gotten cold hits. They've gotten 5,000 cold hits. In other words, a person commits a rape or a murder, leaves blood behind, leaves semen behind. They have no idea who the perpetrator was, but they run it through the database of convicted felons or convicted offenders, and they get a hit. They identify the real perpetrator. They've done that 5,000 times. That's great. That's great police work. And certainly, if the entire nation did have their DNA profile like you just described, we would solve more crimes. But, you know, you have to think about the cost-benefit analysis. My guess is that most people in the country right now would not like to have the entire complement of their personal DNA on file, you know, at the FBI building in Washington, D.C., for a lot of very valid privacy concerns. And until such time that we have a consensus, that we want to have a universal database, then one of the big concerns that we have about these databases of arrestees is that you are inviting, for instance, racial profiling. You're inviting pretext arrests. Mm-hmm. A police officer can want to get somebody's DNA, stop them for a broken taillight, get their DNA, not really have probable cause, not follow through on a prosecution, but get their DNA and keep it there. Mm-hmm. So that's a big concern. And it gets even worse when you realize that we live in a country where racial profiling has been a very real problem for a number of years in all 50 states.
But if you had everybody's DNA, you could say everybody's being treated the same way.
I agree with you. If you had everybody's DNA, then you wouldn't have the problem of race discrimination or pretext arrest. You'd have a privacy concern
right.
About whether or not The government should have everybody's DNA because they can not only know more about your predispositions. We've had people who were denied health insurance because they found out that so-and-so had a cystic fibrosis gene that they were carrying. Mm. We've had other people who were denied work opportunities because they found out that they were carrying a gene which made them more likely in 20 years to get a heart attack. Do we really want the government and our employers to have all that information about us?
Barry Steinhardt?
No, that's exactly the point, which is to say, you know, we've repeatedly asked the folks in the criminal justice agencies who say that they want to collect ever wider scope of DNA records, if they're willing to destroy the DNA afterwards. In other words, just keep the test result that can be used for the purposes of establishing identity. Mm-hmm. And they refuse. Now, that tells you they want it for something else, and inevitably it will be used for something else. And DNA is just different than a fingerprint. It is so much more revealing about us than a fingerprint is.
One other funny and revealing story for you, Ira. In England, they decided they wanted to expand the use of DNA, not just to solve rapes and murders, but also property crimes, burglaries, car thefts. But they realized that they had a problem because when the police arrive at a burglary, for instance, and they see the broken window pane, and they can't get fingerprints from it, but they get a DNA swab off the glass, how do they know that the DNA they're getting came from the perpetrator as opposed from the first uniformed police officer who arrived at the scene and simply pressed his face up against the glass to see where the break-in occurred? And so what they wanted to do was get DNA profiles from every law enforcement officer in England to use for elimination purposes. Well, needless to say, they balked at that because they didn't want their DNA profiles on file with the government. And I ask you, you know, I live in New York City. If we approached the New York City Police Department and said to carry out our goal of doing DNA testing and crime solving, we want every member of the Policeman's Benevolent Association to voluntarily provide a DNA profile to go on file, I'll bet you wouldn't get 5% cooperation.
Do what I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
You agree with that, Barry?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think that police agencies are probably going to be able to do that, partly because they know that DNA information will inevitably be used for other purposes, not simply to identify them, but inevitably. They know how leaky the system is.
I mentioned before you came on, I was talking with Peter, and I said, what if we created an independent agency that would be a forensic agency, would it be independent from police law enforcement agencies that would keep track of the DNA, all the DNA collected? Do you think that might help solve the issue of where the DNA winds up?
Well, no, because in the end, the governance of that agency is going to be exercised by politicians who are going to inevitably decide that they want to use the DNA for other purposes. It's not as if we can, you know, appoint 100 wise men and women and put them off in a separate room and say, only you decide. That the real world doesn't work that way. The, you know, Congress or the state legislatures are going to decide how that information can be used. That's not to say that I don't agree with Peter that we ought to have independent people who do the testing for the criminal justice system, but I don't think it justifies having a universal DNA database.
Let's go to Andy in Davis, California. Hi, Andy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I was concerned about the proposition that was passed in California, and I was wondering specifically if any of you knew whether there are going to be constitutional challenges to that, and if so, how do you think they'll turn out?
Barry?
The answer is yes. There will be constitutional challenges. How they're going to turn out? We're going to bring them to the ACLU and others. But we're hopeful that we will prevail. California, for example, has in its state constitution a fairly strong privacy provision. So we are hopeful of prevailing. You know, the interesting thing is that the vote on that proposition was not as overwhelming, I think, as its supporters had originally anticipated. They thought it would just pass 95%. The vote in the end was 2-1 to pass it, but still there were an awful lot of people who were expressing their opposition.
Yeah, I was one of them, and I was wondering, is it just for federal crimes? Is it only for felonies? Is that
it is for state crimes actually, primarily for felonies? Yes.
Scary to me. That's very scary. And you know, as someone who's been arrested, it's just a scary thing, and not something that I would ever want to see happen.
Well, you have good reason to be scared,
because
this really is becoming for many populations. This is going to become a nearly universal database. We know, for example, that an extremely large number of young men of color, for example, are arrested at some point in their lives. So for many populations, this is going to become a very pervasive kind of DNA collection.
Thanks for calling, Andy.
Thanks a lot.
On the other hand, last week here in New York, we had our first arrest from the John Doe indictment project where Peter, you want to tell us, there was just a sample of DNA collected one time, and the DNA was indicted, right?
Right. And they call it the John Doe indictment.
Right.
And actually, the practice started by a very enterprising young assistant DA in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it really caught on across the country. And what they're doing is, like I said, it's a rape case. A young girl's been raped. They collect the semen. They run it. They get a DNA profile. They run it against the convicted offender database. They don't get a hit. So the person has not been previously convicted of a crime. They don't have his DNA, but they think that one day they'll catch that person and they want to be able to prosecute him. And so what they do is they indict the DNA profile. At the Innocence Project, we think that that's a reasonable compromise because clearly in that kind of case, whoever left that semen on an 11-year-old girl is the person who, in most likely, unless it was consent, committed that crime. And so that's a good solution. In some other jurisdictions, for instance, the U.S. Congress passed a law last week as part of the Justice for All initiative, which did away with the statute of limitations in all federal crimes where DNA is involved. That's a bad solution. And the reason that's a bad solution is there were some very good policy reasons to have statutes of limitation, such as if you all of a sudden want to arrest and prosecute somebody 25 years after the commission of a crime, how's he going to remember where he was 25 years ago? How's he going to be able to find witnesses to give him an alibi? Mm-hmm. How's he going to be, memories fade, evidence disappears. So there were always good policy reasons to have a statute of limitation. The John Doe indictment won't prevent you from coming up with a defense in any other case, but those where the DNA is absolutely essential to the commission of the crime.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Barry?
Well, we, of course, says that the Innocence Project worked in the Congress on that bill. My concerns, our concerns are really the same as Peter's, which is mm-hmm. that provision of the federal bill that's the most offensive is the destruction of the statute of limitations. I mean, it's not only the difficulty 25 years later for a criminal defendant to be able to find witnesses to be able to essentially prove their innocence, which is often what occurs in reality in many trials. But remember what we've been talking about here. We know that there are lots of mistakes being made currently in these DNA labs. How 25 years later are you going to be able to even raise that as a defense? How are you going to be able to say 25 years ago, we know that the evidence in Houston was not handled properly?
Or if you have a case where, let's say, you had a plumber who was working in the house and left some DNA in the house, and then 25 years later, his DNA is on record, and 25 years later, you ask him, what house were you working in? Don't you remember being in this house? And I don't even know where I was. He starts to sound like he's guilty because he can't remember back that far, and his DNA is still on record.
That's why there's a difference between any DNA being involved in the case,
right,
ending the statute of limitations on the one hand, and on the other hand, the John Doe indictment,
right,
where the DNA is actually an element of the crime. It's a completely different situation. Mm-hmm. One makes sense, the other simply doesn't.
Talking about DNA evidence, this anniversary date, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Where do you think this is all going to play out? Let me start with you, Barry Steinhardt. You're going to take this suit to court, so to speak, in California. You're going to challenge the California proposition. What would you be willing to settle for? What would be a good compromise for you, if any?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure the compromise is the right word here. I mean, it seems to me that the constitutional principle here is that we ought not to be taking DNA, which is so revealing, from persons who have not been convicted of any crime. That's what, in a sense, that's what we'd be willing to settle for. We have been, as a matter of public policy, been urging really two things. One, that we limit the collection of DNA to persons actually convicted of a crime, who the courts say we happen to disagree with. The courts have held pretty much universally have a lessened expectation of privacy. And secondly, that we limit the power of that DNA by keeping only the test result, if you will, the identification test result, and then we destroy the underlying sample, which will be used for other kinds of purposes.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Let's go to Calvin in Sparta, Wisconsin. Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Eric. Listen, I got a question just on the scientific end of this. Isn't there something? I'm just wondering if there isn't something in DNA that's sort of like a fingerprint, but is less descriptive, that doesn't actually carry, you know, so much information about a person's genetic background, but is more of a marker that's just specific to that individual, that, you know, that doesn't include anything that, you know, like your predisposition towards mental illness or anything like that, but is, I mean, like a DNA fingerprint.
Yeah.
But doesn't carry all this extra information.
Well, you know, they used to think that that was the case, but a lot of those anonymous markers turned out to have very important information about who you are. More importantly, police don't want to limit themselves to those kinds of markers, because now what police want to do is, for instance, there's a blood stain at a crime scene, and they don't get a hit from the national database. They want to know as much as possible about the person they should be looking for. So, for instance, if it comes from a female. Is this a female who may have the gene for breast cancer? If so, they'll go to clinics where women get treated for breast cancer. Is this somebody who has a history of some kind of psychopathology? If so, they'll go to mental health clinics. So police want to know as much about somebody. They don't want to limit themselves to anonymous markers.
Mm-hmm. One more question to you, Peter, before we leave. When someone is exonerated from a crime for which they had been convicted, do the prosecutors reopen the file? Trying to find the person who actually committed the crime?
I mean, rarely. In fact, though, we have worked with police and prosecutors around the country whenever we get an exoneration to try and use the DNA profile from the crime scene to identify the real perpetrator. To date, of the 152 people who have been exonerated, in one-third of those cases, in 50 of those cases, we've been able to identify the real perpetrator. But if we didn't, you know, push them to do this, and they didn't do it with DNA, they would not reopen the files. They never reopen the files. And it's an unfortunate situation because, remember, every time you convict the wrong guy, the real bad guy is still out there committing more crimes. So the kind of reforms that we're talking about here have to do not just with protecting innocent people, but with making law enforcement a much more functioning institution.
All right, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests, Peter Neufeld, co-director of the Innocence Project, and Barry Steinhardt, director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a birthday celebration. The transistor radio turns 50, believe it or not. 50 years old. Remember all those World Series you sat in classrooms with a little earphone threaded up your... Well, we'll talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.